From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Barons of Bankruptcy grossed $3.3 billion before their companies went bust, in the meantime wiping out hundreds of billions of dollars of shareholder value and nearly 100,000 jobs.
A Financial Times survey of how top corporate executives made extraordinary personal fortunes even as their companies were heading for disaster. Next, we'll look at where some of Enron's billions were spent. In one case, a former Enron executive bought one of the most contested land tracts in the country. The Hispanic community says it's their birthright. We'll go to the activists on the land. And secret detentions and deportations, this time, it's the Haitian population. Dozens of Haitians who survived a harrowing journey from Haiti on a sailboat are summarily deported. We'll be joined by actor Danny Glover, who went down to Florida to protest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. This news from Jerusalem, a bomb ripped through a cafeteria on the campus of Israel's Hebrew University as students ate lunch yesterday, killing seven people, including five Americans, in an attack claimed by Hamas as revenge for an attack last week that targeted its military chief, but claimed the lives of 14 others as well. The explosive detonated in the early afternoon, blowing out glass windows and overturning tables at the Frank Sinatra International Student Center. The survivors ran out into the Nancy Reagan Plaza. Meanwhile, the Reverend Jesse Jackson turned around on his way to a meeting with the founder of Hamas after it said that it had carried out the afternoon bombing. This news from the Washington Post: Vice President Dick Cheney and War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld are pushing forcefully for aggressively confronting Saddam Hussein, but Secretary of State General Colin Powell and the Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet are asking skeptical questions about a military campaign, especially about what would happen in the aftermath. Much of the senior uniform military is opposing going to war anytime soon. They say sanctions and continual bombing over the so-called no-fly zones imposed not by the United Nations but by the U.S. and Britain alone. They say those zones are working. They say Saddam Hussein has not become an immediate threat. Meanwhile, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee continues its second day of hearings on whether or not to attack Iraq. A U.S. federal judge has ruled the 600 prisoners at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have no right to bring their cases to U.S. courts. This is because they're foreign nationals and because they're imprisoned outside the sovereign territory of the U.S., the judge says. None of the prisoners have been charged with any crime. Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights said, quote, "The judge says they have access to international law, but it isn't clear how they would ever get it if they can never see their lawyers or have any form of due process. The U.S. calls countries the world over to task for these sorts of abuses." Hundreds of New York City low-wage workers marched on Washington yesterday, chanting "Health care, not toxic air" in Cantonese, Spanish, and English. The workers say the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has denied low-income residents of Lower Manhattan emergency aid for health care, rent, and unemployment in the wake of September 11th. Michael Alon of the Beyond Ground Zero Network was there. Can you tell us about the protest?
Sure. Hi, Amy. Hi, Juan. Well, there was about 1,000 of us from New York City, mostly low-income families from the Lower East Side and Chinatown and other communities of color from around New York, that marched on the White House yesterday to charge the Bush administration with discriminating against and excluding thousands of low-income workers and residents from government assistance and, in general, from the entire rebuilding process. We want to demand that Bush get his priorities straight and put the health of New York's working people first, that he and his administration not only fix what's been wrong or insufficient about FEMA and the way it's directed other agencies like the EPA, for example, to act, but that they include working people, especially low-income folks who were hardest hit by September 11th and the collateral effects, in the rebuilding process, which means rebuilding people's health, protecting manufacturing jobs and low-income housing, especially in Lower Manhattan, and creating some kind of giving some kind of reparations, creating some kind of medical institution that studies and treats the short and long-term effects of what people are sure to face in terms of health problems from the toxic air. And I know Juan has studied that and written about that extensively.
Well, Michael, the government has earmarked all these billions of dollars for Lower Manhattan, and Senator Hillary Clinton is pressing for release of, I think, about $90 million or more to chart the health needs of the Ground Zero emergency workers. What has happened with the folks in Chinatown and the other outlying poorer communities?
Well, first of all, as far as Senator Clinton's proposal, I think it's a good step. It's a small step in the right direction, but it's narrow. It does address several thousand workers' needs, but just the Ground Zero workers. And I think she's responding to some pressure that we and other groups are putting on to include more folks in the rebuilding process, in the responding to people's health problems. As far as the $2 billion that or more that has come from the federal government to Lower Manhattan, and it really has gone. I mean, and you can look at some statistics and see the disparity about where money's going, not only between wealthy and poor working folks, you know, residents of Lower Manhattan, what have you, but, you know, even I think it's $500 million went to 100 or 140, 150 large corporations. Less than $13 million went to people, you know, that the money was paid to the corporations so that they would stay, these grant money, so they would stay in Lower Manhattan, but less than $13 million, I think, has been spent in giving folks mortgage and rental assistance, you know, something that they definitely need to, so that they're not displaced from their homes. And we know of many who already have been because they were ineligible for FEMA aid.
Michael Lalonde with the Beyond Ground Zero Network. Newly released documents show that President Bush and Vice President Cheney served in leadership positions at companies that set up subsidiaries in offshore tax havens. Texas oil company Harkin Energy set up a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands while Bush was a director. Texas energy company Halliburton registered at least 20 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands when Cheney was chief executive. In both cases, officials denied that the purpose was to evade taxes. Democrats say the revelations show the president and the vice president failed to practice the corporate policies they now preach. The White House has in recent days railed against the practice of setting up subsidiaries in tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Meanwhile, Vice President Dick Cheney's tenure as chief executive of Halliburton is under scrutiny from government investigators. A report in the New York Times talks about the Securities Exchange Commission investigation into changes made by the company in its accounting practices for construction projects while Cheney led Halliburton. The company and its shareholders have also suffered from the hidden costs from a deal that was at the time the high point of Cheney's five-year Halliburton career, his acquisition of Dresser Industries in 1998. The deal, which Cheney hailed as a win-win merger, ended up saddling the company with the growing costs of legal claims from people who say they were injured by or are at risk from asbestos and products made by Dresser and a former Dresser subsidiary that was spun off in 1992. And the Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into the accounting practices of AOL Time Warner. Downsizing. Colin Scott Johnson came into our studio yesterday, inspired by Democracy Now!, and had just recorded the song two nights ago. His email address is scottjohnson1@aol.com. Thanks very much, Colin. Downsizing certainly fits in with our top story today. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners around the country.
Well, they are the Barons of Bankruptcy, a privileged group of top business people who made extraordinary personal fortunes, even as their companies were heading for disaster. They made their money at the top of the market, selling shares in companies whose values rocketed in 1999 and 2000. Today, their companies, many in the telecommunications sector, have crashed, destroying hundreds of billions of dollars of investor wealth and almost 100,000 jobs. Yet the executives and directors of these bankrupt companies have walked away with gross earnings of $3.3 billion, a stunning payoff for corporate failure. This is how a report in yesterday's Financial Times begins. It's part of an exhaustive inquiry by the Financial Times into executive compensation at the largest U.S. bankruptcies, covering the 25 largest U.S. public companies to go bankrupt since January 2001. Among the barons of bankruptcy are the familiar names: Ken Lay, former chair and CEO of Enron, grossed close to $250 million. Jeff Skilling, former Enron president, grossed $89 million. Even these figures are dwarfed by the $512 million grossed by Gary Winnick of Global Crossing. We're joined now by Yen Chang, who is the Financial Times reporter who is doing this three-part series. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good to be here, Amy.
And Yen, tell us a little bit about these, some of the individuals. Maybe everyone's heard of Ken Lay and Winnick, but some of the others that you uncovered that haven't gotten the kind of play, but who in this short three-year period walked away with millions and millions of dollars.
One good example that's detailed in a part two by some of my colleagues in today's paper is an executive at Metro Media Fiber Network. They aggressively built fiber networks, building up lots of debt and hardly making any profit, making billions in losses. In the meantime, their executives together grossed almost $300 million between them. One example, Howard Finkelstein, he sold over $100 million in shares just a few months before his resignation.
I mean, even with someone like Ken Lay or Gary Winnick of Global Crossing, $250 million, they made in the 3 years, how does it happen right before the company is going under? How do they actually do it?
Well, I think we have to be careful. They're not right before. We shouldn't get this idea that they've got this 11th hour conspiracy. In most of the cases, there are actually some cases that fit that mold, but in most cases, it's a structural problem over several years. In the 1999-2000 booms, they were following the hype in the market and able to sell out millions. We have to be fair. Other people, other investors made money as well. However, the companies were not structurally sound. They didn't have healthy business models. They were building billions in debt. And so within a year, they were failing and laying off people.
In terms of the bulk of the wealth that most of these folks cashed in had to do more with stock options than any other form of compensation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's right, Juan. Of the $3.3 billion, a mere $155 million is in base salaries. That is eclipsed by about $250 million in bonuses, some of which is discretionary, retention bonus, and so on. And the rest, almost 90%, is the share sales and stock options.
How do you do an investigation like this? How do you put this together to really figure out how much money these executives are making as their companies are failing?
Well, in principle, it's straightforward. As these are public companies, the salaries and bonuses are disclosed in their annual reports and proxy statements. As for share sales, insiders, and there's a strict definition of those insiders, executives, directors, and other major shareholders, have to report their sales to the SEC. And it's all there for anyone to look at. In practice, the records aren't always clear. There are mistakes. Especially in the case of bankrupt companies, they often don't have to file annual reports in the year or two before their troubles begin, because they're in trouble. You know, I found mistakes in the records that have been misreported elsewhere, and then to interpret the sales themselves once you have them is not always easy, because they're not always straight profits.
And of the list that you have in yesterday's story, there were 8 executives that walked away with more than $100 million each.
That's right, Juan. And that doesn't include one other executive who we didn't include in the number for consistency reasons.
In terms of the breakdown, could you tell us a little bit about what are we talking about here in terms of the top
sure.
executives and how many there were
exactly.
that were involved in all of these?
Well, we looked at 208 people. Those were the top executives whose salaries were reported publicly, plus another 20 or so directors who sold at least $1 million of shares. Now, the wealth is fairly concentrated to the top quartile of those people. The 52 top grossing people account for $2.9 billion of the total. So there are 52 people who made more than $10 million. There are 16 people who made more than $25 million. 31 people who made more than $25 million. And 16 people made more than $50 million. And 8 more than $100 million.
So basically you're saying about 52 people walked away with most of the money.
Almost $3 billion, that's right, yes.
In over 3 years of corporate bankruptcies, of the 25 largest bankruptcies in the country has seen.
That's right. And we think that's a conservative figure because we have only counted 3 years. In some very notable cases, including Winnick and Lay, they made hundreds before 1999, which we haven't counted.
What about Pai of Enron? Not as familiar a name, the one we're going to go into in our next segment more extensively.
And who walked away with more money than Ken Lay.
That's right. Liu Pai is one of my favorite examples, really. He actually doesn't make our list because his salaries were never reported. But we've counted up his numbers because they're so extraordinary. Now, I feel a little bit sorry for the chap because he was misreported in the Washington Post of gaining over $350 million. Well, that's not true. He only made $270 million. So we tried to get it right and be fair to the guy. He apparently had a nasty divorce in 2000, as the company was telling me, and that was one of the reasons he had to sell out.
And he was. And what was his role? He was on the in Enron.
He was one of the second tier executives. I think he ran the Enron Energy division. Yeah.
You also talk in your piece, Yen Cheng, about the different ways that people made their money, not just salaries, as you said, but retention bonuses, dividends, shareholdings, forgiven loans. What are retention bonuses?
Retention bonuses are what is often millions that a company will pay an executive to stay at the company when things get bad. So here's an executive who arguably is to blame for the troubles, who instead of being asked to leave, is being asked to stay, but having to be paid millions to do so.
So he keeps taking more money,
exactly.
And the company keeps giving him more money.
That's
to
right.
stay and keep taking more money.
Well, I think, you know, each situation is unique. And, in these stories, it's often very hard to pinpoint a single culprit.
What is the New York State Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, saying about all this? You did a piece in today's Financial Times.
Well, we're reporting on our front page today that Elliot Spitzer has looked at our report and has found it rather interesting. I think our quote is that the findings are amazing, that the outrage is justified, and he is certainly looking at many of the names on our list, some of whom he hadn't investigated previously.
Where would legality or illegality come in here?
We are not in this series allegating alleging any criminality. There was a structural problem in American capitalism, and which allowed these things to happen, often very much within the law. However, there may well be accounting problems in some of the cases, and other suspicious last-minute deals where executives arranged million-dollar pay packages months before bankruptcy happened.
Well, I want to thank you. It's an eye-opening piece, and leave it to the Financial Times to report it, because much of the U.S.-based media in this country has been asleep at the switch, as these corporate shenanigans have been going on the last several years.
If people want to see the whole series, Barons of Bankruptcy, how the money was made by these top corporate executives, where can they go on the web if they don't actually get the paper?
Sure. The whole series, part one and two, and part three, which is being published in tomorrow's edition, is available online, ft.com/barons.
Can you give us a preview of tomorrow?
Well, yesterday we diagnosed the problem. Today we go into specific examples, and tomorrow we suggest solutions.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Yen Cheng is author of one of the major pieces in this series, Barons of Bankruptcy. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
When we come back, we're going to look at Liu Pei, one of the corporate executives who made a fortune, and look at the land he bought with it in Colorado, its historical significance and its significance today, especially amongst a group of Mexican Americans.
Bigger is always better. Bigger is always better. Bigger is always better. Sitting there drinking, but some things are better left small. But when you put a lot of small things together, you get something bigger, and that's better. Now why tell a white lie when you can tell a whopper? Why be a bad guy when you can be a copper? Why be copper when you can be gold? Why be gold when you can be platinum? Why be platinum?
Denny Bonet, bigger is always better here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, top executives and directors of the biggest business collapses amassed billions of dollars in salary and share sales while the stock market was still booming. According to the Financial Times, in just 3 years, they grossed about $3.3 billion before their companies went bust. The bankruptcies wiped out hundreds of billions of dollars of shareholder value and nearly 100,000 jobs. Here at Democracy Now!, we've looked at the scandals behind the bankruptcies and the workers who've lost their jobs and retirement savings, but we haven't yet looked at where some of the executives' billions have been spent.
Today we're going to talk about a case involving former Enron executive Liu Pei, who has cashed out more than $270 million in stock since 1999. That's nearly three times the amount former CEO Ken Lay made away with. Liu Pei is at the center of one of the most controversial land claims in the country. He used $23 million from Enron stock to buy a 77,000-acre ranch that members of the mostly Hispanic community of San Luis in Colorado say is their birthright. The story of this community's dispossession is a long one, dating back to the Mexican-American War and involving the National Forest Service, Nelson Rockefeller, Forbes, and now Enron's Liu Pei. Most recently, the Colorado Supreme Court issued a historic ruling that residents of San Luis are entitled to graze livestock and cut timber on Pai's ranch. We're joined now by Adam Saitanides, a freelance journalist who has long covered this story, and he tells us the story of this land. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Adam.
Thank you. Good morning, Juan. Basically, what we have here is kind of a town that time forgot, and as far as San Luis is concerned. This piece of property that Pai now owns was specifically set aside as part of the original Mexican land grant that established a settlement of the area when it was still Mexican territory in 1844. And the original patron who controlled the settlement of the area set aside all the uplands, all the forested mountain lands, for communal use. This is where people got timber to build their homes, where they traditionally grazed their animals in the summertime, hunted, fished, etc. And a clause on There had always been an underlying owner of this property, but the town was able to use it communally. And a clause was attached to the deed, to the title of this property, which said that the ownership of the property was, and I'm quoting here, subject to the claims of the local people to rights of pasture, wood and lumber, and so-called settlement rights upon the land. And so you have a situation where within United States territory, the Mexican settlement traditions and Mexican property law is very pertinent.
Now, as most people are not aware, most Americans clearly are not aware that when the U.S.-Mexico War ended and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed, that there were rights of the original Mexican residents of the now U.S. territory that were also guaranteed by the treaty, right?
That's correct. Part of the deal that was struck to end the war, which essentially was a war of conquest, was that the Mexican people's property rights would be respected. The language in the treaty says, I'm quoting again, property rights of every kind now belonging to Mexicans established there shall be inviolably respected. And that's a phrase that land-grant activists and the lawyers in the Lupi case love to bring up, because those treaties have the property rights of the Mexican Americans under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo have not been respected much more than Indian rights to land have been respected under the Indian treaties.
It's very interesting to look at who got a lot of this land, the carved up land grants that have become the crown jewel real estate holdings of the nation's most wealthy and powerful. You write, Adam Satanides, the Forbes family owned vast swaths bordering the Taylor Ranch, which is the one that was bought up by Pye, to the north, while Ted Turner's Vermejo Park Ranch lies catty corner to the south. The Rockefellers snatched up one of the most hotly contested grants near Tierra Amarilla in New Mexico. But then you've got the Taylor Ranch, named for the millionaire lumberman from North Carolina who's a descendant of President Zachary Taylor. Tell us what he did with it and what happened to the land under him, and then how it ended up in Lupi's hands.
Well, Taylor ended up buying the ranch in 1960, and he was not very afraid of dealing with these settlers' rights. I mean, people in town, in the rural villages of San Luis, pretty much had free and open access to this land. It wasn't fenced, and people referred to it just in general as La Sierra, the mountain. Taylor bought it for just around $500,000. This is almost 78,000 acres. And part of the reason the land was so cheap is because there was this cloud on the title. He set about fencing the property. There were a lot of very controversial conflicts between individual members of the local community and Taylor and his guards. People were beaten if they were found up there, and Taylor didn't want them to be up there. The local community did not really take this lying down. At one point, Taylor was shot by a sniper in the ankle while he was reclining in his cabin in 1975. So you had this kind of low-level range war going on, like the Wild West for a while, and until 1981, it seemed as though Taylor was in pretty good control of keeping the people out. He'd successfully fenced it. But in 1981, there was a lawsuit filed, which is the Colorado Supreme Court decision you referred to, which attempted to reestablish the community's rights to the land.
Well, we're also joined on the phone by Ray Otero, a lifetime land-grant activist who's an integral part of the Chicano movement and who went to San Luis in the late 1970s and helped to organize the community around the lawsuit. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ray. Could you tell us a little bit about the how the community got organized and what happened once the suit was filed?
Well, the community had been in struggle long before I got there in 1975. I basically organized the community into a legal team and its heirs, and we proceeded from there to document the case, which was well documented. There's ample evidence in all the documents that that the rights of the people were to be set and was to be used by all the inhabitants of the community at that point.
Ironically, Ray, you were employed by Enron and lost your job and savings in the Enron scandals. What kind of connections are you making here with going there to fight for this land and it being owned now by one of the chief executives of Enron, Liu Pei?
I returned back from San Luis after we filed a lawsuit in 1981, came back home to Grand Junction, Colorado, where I went to work for a company by the name of Northern Natural Gas Company. About 3 or 4 years after I started working with them, the company was consumed by Enron Corporation. And in the process of all of this, I lost probably 150, 200 shares of stock.
And in terms of how the battle developed in the courts, the lower courts, for the most part, for years, just basically dismissed the lawsuit. Or could you tell us a little bit about what happened in the lower courts?
We never found a judge that had the guts to take on this issue. The issue is clear. That's why I got involved with it. All of the documents that the people have to their property makes reference to their rights to use this mountain. And so it was clear on paper that people had these rights. It's just that the courts continued to step back on the people and not take advantage of the truth. And eventually it got to the Supreme Court, where 6 judges heard it, and it was a little more difficult for them to dismiss it as they had in the past.
We're talking about this area called La Sierra in Colorado. That was the Taylor Ranch. Liu Pei and Enron executives bought the land with $23 million he acquired by liquidating now worthless Enron stock. It's certainly, though, not worthless land. As we're hearing, Ray Otero with us, as well as Shirley Otero, the wife of Ray, also from San Luis, her family a plaintiff in the lawsuit. When the lawsuit was heard by the first state court judge, he said, "I don't want to hear anything about old Mexican law." Well, that's changed a little now. Shirley, can you tell us about that?
Well, that's changed a lot. I think that the political climate in this country has changed the fact that Latinos in this country are becoming a political and economic force. 22 years later, after we filed the lawsuit, the Colorado Supreme Court looked at this, and like Ray said, there was no way that they could rule against this and say we have done justice to these people. The community never let the struggle down. We were always there in all of the 15 courts that we have been before. This time, like Ray says, it was difficult for those judges to say that we had no claim. Previous judges did not want to hear any history before 1863, and our whole case, the majority of our case, depended on that 1863 Bovian document. This court had the courage to look at that and say, how can we say these people have no rights when we've lived there for over 100 years and have used that mountain up until 1960, when Taylor denied access by putting up the fence. So this court is a more progressive court, and looked at this the way it should, looked at all the documents and everything we presented in our brief, took it into consideration, and then ruled in our favor. So we're very happy about that.
Well, you know, often the most Americans have heard something about pre-Mexican War settlers in Texas and in New Mexico, but very little is heard about the Mexican population of Colorado. Could you talk a little bit about the role of Mexican Americans within Colorado and the relative importance of within the entire state?
Well, this case is going to have ripple effects on other land grant issues. Our case, the Sierra case, was the only case, land grant case, that has gone this far in the judicial system in this country. So land grant heirs in New Mexico are looking at this issue. There is a GAO study that is being done on land grants and is going to be introduced into Congress in December. So they're already looking at that, to say nothing of the ripple effects that it'll have on Native American lands. That's just within our borders. this decision is going to have ripple effects not only in this country, but internationally as well. And again, I must emphasize that this country has not taken our power seriously. They've tried to stifle our power by doing away with our language rights, by doing away with our land rights, and we're saying that the United States signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo with Mexico. They have a right to uphold those decisions and the rights that were guaranteed to us under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. It's a very early decision. It's going to have overwhelming impact on other indigenous people, and we are going to wait and see what that is, because we ourselves don't know what that's going to be.
I'm looking at a piece in the Rocky Mountain News titled "Lasso Thrown Around Taylor Ranch, Enron Investors Workers Aim to Hogtie Former Exec's Property to Recover Losses." And it says, Pai's colleagues at Enron dubbed the property with its streams, aspen meadows, and dense forests Mount Pai. According to former Enron employees, the ranch makes Pai one of Colorado's largest private landowners. Carol Broderick, a Philadelphia lawyer representing Enron bondholders, said anyone at Enron who sold stock with insider knowledge is liable for the losses of people who bought on the same day. And a Houston attorney named Joseph McDermott, who represents the investment firm Stero Asset Management, said the suit seeking to freeze the assets of Enron executives specifically mentions Pai's Colorado property. Now, what would that mean in your lawsuit if in fact the suit seeking to freeze the assets of Enron executives somehow was able to lay claim to the Colorado property? Ray Otero, since you are an Enron employee who lost everything there, could you gain something from this?
Let me say this first, and then Ray can answer. With this Supreme Court decision, we take precedent before anybody else. Whoever buys this mountain buys that lawsuit. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not real clear as to what's going to happen in the courts if they put a lien on that property. But our rights go before anybody else's rights. And I will let Ray continue to answer this question.
What we're gaining is justice, more than anything else, and the access to the land. We have nothing personally to gain from it other than to see the victory. I'm from this community. I have no other intention of using the land in San Luis or anything like that. But it is a fantastic victory for oppressed people throughout the world.
And, of course, in land tenure policy within the United States, many Anglo-Americans have difficulty with the concept of having grazing rights as opposed to just owning the land outright. And what you're defending is this historic right of the original settlers of that territory to have grazing rights. Right? So that's why you're saying that people will not necessarily directly benefit, but it is a right of the community.
Right. It's always been a right, and of course the grazers will benefit from it by their animals being on the land, by the fact that they can now take their cattle up to the mountain during the summertime while their lower lands grow the pasture that they use for the winter. But it's something that should have never been closed. They've been closed off this land for 42 years now. And it's just been a horrible injustice all along, and it's about time that this wrong was righted.
Shirley and Ray Otero, we want to thank you for being with us, and Adam Saitanides, a freelance journalist who did a piece on the Colorado land that we have been talking about. Adam Saitanides, if people want to see your piece, where can they go on the web?
Actually, it was the last piece I published on the Taylor Ranch was part of a Hispanic Link newsletter. So you would have to get in touch with Hispanic Link in Washington, D.C. Otherwise, you could do a Google search on my name, and there's a whole bunch of Pacifica stories on it.
Thanks very much.
All right.
And it was the July 15th issue of Hispanic Link Weekly Report. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going south to Florida. Danny Glover will join us to talk about what's happening to Haitians who are put in detention and then deported. Stay with us.
himself. Yeah, country loved. And mercy more than life. America.
Ray Charles, America the Beautiful. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And Democracy Now!, we've talked a lot about secret detentions and deportations as part of a wave of repression against Arabs and South Asians since September 11th. But Haitians are also a target. On Monday, more than two dozen Haitians were summarily deported from the United States. They've been held in maximum security prisons for more than 6 months and denied access to medical care, interpretation services, lawyers, and legal materials. Most of the deportees were survivors of a highly publicized sailboat journey to South Florida. On December 3rd, nearly 200 asylum seekers aboard a crammed 31-foot wooden boat ran aground off Miami shores. Their arrival triggered a tightening in immigration policy toward Haitian migrants. Before December, Haitians who were able to show a credible fear of persecution in their homeland lived freely while they waited for their case to be reviewed.
But since December, Haitian asylum seekers have been kept in prolonged detention while an immigration judge decides their status. Immigration advocates, members of Miami's Haitian community, and an array of local politicians have charged that the policy is racist and have filed a class action lawsuit. This week, they have been holding regular protests outside the INS offices in Miami. On Saturday, actor and activist Danny Glover met with some of the detained immigrants at a Miami jail and spoke at a Miami Forum for Workers' Rights.
And Danny Glover joins us on the phone right now. He's just gone back to San Francisco from Miami. Danny Glover, can you tell us what you did there?
Well, we met with a group of at the detention center, at the TGK detention center. We met with a group of women, not only Haitians, but of all the other nationalities, at the detention center, and spoke with them. Mainly to boost their morale, you know, myself, State Senator Meeks, and other advocates were there to meet with the women and to talk with them. Certainly, they had been demoralized by the conditions that they lived under. They were certainly very down because of that, and we attempted to tell them that we were. Were still on the case, and that were people out on the outside were concerned about what's happening with them, and certainly that justice would prevail. This was Saturday.
Well, Danny, the U.S. immigration policy, especially when it comes to Haitians, continues to have this seesaw back and forth. We remember the first Bush administration when the Chrome Detention Center became infamous for its treatment of Haitian refugees back then. Is there any difference in terms of what's happening now, or why do you think this is happening at this point?
Well, essentially, there's so many issues that surround this the whole policy. Certainly, we contend that the policy is racist, that it excludes Haitians in particular, and that the policy in itself, as supposedly a deterrent from a mass exodus, is against international law. Certainly, United Nations High Commission Commission for Refugees has stated that, and many other organizations, Amnesty International, and other organizations have stated that as a fact. There's been a long, as you say, history that we've had with Haitians with Haitian refugees, whether that was during the periods of time during the Duvall. A dictatorship during periods of time through the military coup after the election of President Aristide. There's been this ongoing tension, unlike other refugees, asylum seekers in the area, in South Florida certainly has been very different with Haitian refugees.
Cheryl Little is also on the line with us, Executive Director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center. Cheryl, you filed appeals on behalf of about 100 of the Haitian asylum seekers. What has happened?
Well, the cards are really stacked against this group of Haitian asylum seekers. You can well imagine most have no attorneys. Had they been released like virtually all other similarly situated asylum seekers in the Miami District, they would have had about a year to find lawyers and prepare their cases. Because they're not released, their cases have been expedited.
Explain what that means when you say like other people. What happens to people when they file to stay in this country? How are they treated?
Well, in 1996, there were laws that said we're going to mandatorily detain asylum seekers who arrive at ports of entry like the Miami airport. And before they're eligible for release, they have to convince an asylum officer that they have a substantial likelihood of proving their eligibility for asylum. In the Miami District, until December 3rd, most asylum seekers who passed that credible fear test were being quickly released. And then they had an opportunity to find a lawyer and prepare their case. Since December 3rd, Haitians have been singled out, and they haven't been released. And their cases have been expedited. They've moved in a number of judges from the downtown Miami courtroom to hear the Haitian cases. The judges have been hearing up to holding up to five hearings a day. Some of these hearings are half an hour to an hour only. That's with translation. Haitians have had to complete asylum applications in English, and have had great difficulty doing that. So it's no surprise that many of them have been denied asylum. Attorneys, we've had extreme difficulty in accessing our clients. And the Board of Immigration Appeals recently started issuing summary denials, where in one or two sentences they're affirming the judge's decision. In effect, these Haitians have been denied their day in court. They're extremely depressed, they're extremely despondent, demoralized, because they see other asylum seekers quickly come and go. And that is also making it more difficult for them to articulate their asylum claims. So we're very, very concerned that these Haitians are being denied due process and that their fundamental constitutional rights are being abused.
And of course, there are periodic boats that wash up on shore of Cubans leaving Cuba, but the Cubans are not treated in anywhere near the same manner by INS, are they?
Well, if Cubans make it here, because of the Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966, once they're paroled, they're eligible to apply for legal residency a year and a day later. And in fact, when the 1996 laws requiring the expedited of asylum seekers was passed, Cubans were exempted from that.
Didn't, in fact, yesterday, scores of Cubans who had come up for a World Youth Day defected to the United States.
That's right.
We're also joined in our studio by Ray LaForest, co-coordinator of the Haiti Support Network, a union organizer, and Pacifica National Board member. Welcome, Ray.
Hello.
Why are people leaving Haiti now?
Well, this is a difficult situation. Haiti is a very poor country. It's been so for a long time, partially due to U.S. foreign policy. And the policy vis-a-vis Haiti has always been influenced certainly by racism. And definitely by the attitude of United States government vis-a-vis the Haitian administration. Presently, they've been trying to put pressure on the administration since 1997. They have denied them grants, vetoed or blocked grants from international institutions. And indeed, things are much tougher in Haiti than they used to be. As a result, again, of U.S. Decision when Aristide was brought back after a coup, after spending about 3 years in his country and Venezuela, the U.S. decided that they would not disarm paramilitary forces present in the country. As a matter of fact, they forced Aristide to include half of the former army, made up of thugs and killers, within that new police force. So these are all elements that have been percolating. Since Haiti is really completely isolated these days, suffering isolation because of U.S. policy, around an issue that arose around an election that brought the Lavalas party, our president, actually Fermín Lavalas, to power, where U.S. insists that unless changes were made, Haiti would get no assistance whatsoever. And actually, the seven senators who had gained from that election stepped down and have never served except for a short period. And however, the assistance was never given back to Haiti.
Well, Danny Glover, when you were down in Miami, you also spoke at a health workers rally. And, of course, many of the Haitians who do manage to get permanent residency here in the United States still have to confront all kinds of discrimination and difficulty in being able to survive. What were you? What was the message that you were bringing to that health workers rally?
Well, the health workers rally had involved support of Haitian workers at the Mount Sinai nursing home, who had voted for union representation, and management appealed that vote and based their appeal on the fact that Haitians had been that voodoo had influenced their voting. As a result of that, the National Labor Relations Board denied that appeal, and the appeal itself was then challenged again. The denial was challenged, and we were rallying. We had a protest in support of those workers, and those workers, the issues around the right to organize, first of all, issues around a living wage, very important issues in terms of health workers, these health workers.
Did I hear you right? You said the management was claiming that voodoo was involved in your workers?
Voodoo was involved. I mean, it's also a very highly publicized case situation in Florida, in Miami, about the nursing home where they were the management claimed that voodoo influenced practices influenced the vote of these Haitians, which is ridiculous.
Speaking of workers, weren't two workers rallying in Haiti recently killed? Ray?
Yeah, this is a very sad situation, difficult. What happened because of tremendous the pressures that I mentioned in trying to survive, the ICC administration has not always done the right thing. Recently, in trying to compromise with dictates of structural adjustment programs, they've decided, for example, to allocate a portion of the border to investment by the United States and Dominican Republic, and this is what's reflected in what the case you're talking about. These are workers who were working with out of a place called Gossimau, and working with Cointreau, a liquor company from France. And where they've been allowed for years, 30 years or more, to plant, to grow food when the land was not being utilized. And recently, as they started organizing into a trade union as a countermeasure to discourage them, they were denied those rights. And as they organized a demonstration, they were set upon a group of thugs, and they were attacked. Two reporters were present, one of them from Haiti Progress and another one from Radio Pacifique. Were also assaulted and were arrested. And the role of the state administration is really quite murky. These individuals, first, none of the people who attacked those workers were arrested, and the individuals were wounded. And two of them killed, as you said, two elderly protesters were killed due to machete blows. And the remaining of the nine workers are in jail since about 2 months.
Danny Glover, you've long been interested in Haiti. You're chair of TransAfrica, the board of TransAfrica. And you've been working on a film on Haiti?
Well, I've been working on a project about the Haitian Revolution. 2004 marks the 200th year anniversary of the victory of that revolution. And certainly the... At 200 years of a very disappointing relationship, to say the least, that the country of Haiti's had with the United States. It also began a 60-year embargo of Haiti by the United States after the victory in that revolution. I've been working on that film for some time. It's been certainly one of my objectives to do a movie about this heroic struggle.
Well, the first 100 years was spent by not just the United States, was it, but also, of course, France kept trying, demanding to be paid reparations for granting Haiti independence.
Yes. Yeah.
And, of course, Haiti was born from the independent country of Haiti, the Republic of Haiti, from a slave uprising. And wasn't the U.S. afraid, the U.S. Congress members were afraid that it would inspire slaves in the United States?
Well, it did inspire slaves in the United States. The Denmark Vesey revolt in South Carolina was with the intention of that revolt was to commandeer ships to Haiti out of the harbor in South Carolina. Of course it did. I'm sure it inspired countless attempts by slaves here during that period of time to free themselves, you know, to end their own bondage. We're not often told that about history because we're not told about slave revolts. They're not legitimate legitimate in the process of freeing yourself of revolt. And so certainly the case, we have such a warped understanding of the history of Haiti. We assume in our relationship with Haitians has been that they've been basically boat people or immigrants or at the bottom of the barrel, and yet they have such an incredible history and an incredible people.
And in fact, in the 19th century, certainly in the early 19th century, Haiti became a base area for the Latin American revolutions because Simón Bolívar was given refuge there by the Haitian presidents and helped to inspire a lot of the Latin American revolutionaries to kick off Spanish colonialism.
Absolutely. And also the fact we could also say, we even go further, that mulattoes and Haitians were fought in the American Revolution as well, volunteered to fight the American Revolution.
That's true. And you said Bolivar, and before Bolivar, Miranda sought help and refuged and got assistance in Haiti. And in Savannah, Georgia, Haitians fought on behalf of the United States. And it can be argued that in defeating some of Napoleon Bonaparte's best troops in Haiti, that they helped decide indeed the Louisiana territory would not be used. Napoleon planned them, especially on his way in the Americas.
Well, on that historical note, we have to wrap up the program. I want to thank you all for being with us. Ray LaForest of the Haiti Support Network, actor Danny Glover, and Cheryl Little, Executive Director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center. That does it for the program. If you want to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. And again, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, still healing from the tsunami that hit him in Virginia Beach. If you'd like to send us books on tape or healing music, we'll bring them to Anthony. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. Miranda is filling in for him today. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
Now, wait a minute. I'm talking about